There were four different house designs interspersed in a predictable pattern. Each had a newish car in the driveway and evidence of children. Small bicycles with stabilizers, a basketball hoop fixed to the garage wall. But there was neither sight nor sound of any. The streets were all named after poets. Wordsworth Lane, Shelley Close, Keats Rise. No doubt chosen by the building company's marketing department. They were all poets that the kind of person who'd aspire to such a home would recognize. Poets who wrote about urns and flowers and wandering clouds. Based on past experience, I'd be more likely to end up living in Dante Lane or Poe Crescent. I was very familiar with such environs, having lived in several virtually identical houses and virtually identical streets during foster placements. There would be no pensioners here, no friends sharing a house, and no one living alone, save for the occasional transitory divorcee. Newish cars lined up in driveways, two per house, ideally. Families came and went, and the whole place felt temporary somehow, like theatrical scenery that had been hastily assembled and could be shifted at any time. I shuddered, chasing away the memories. Raymond's mother lived in a neat terrace behind the newer houses, a row of tiny pebble-dashed semis. It was social housing. The streets here were named after obscure local politicians. Those who had purchased their homes had fitted UPVC double-glazed front doors or added little porches. Raymond's family homestead was unmodified. Raymond ignored the front door and walked around the side of the house. The back garden had a shed with net curtains in the window and a square of green lawn marked by clothes poles. Washing flapped on the line, pegged out with military precision, a row of plain white sheets and towels, and then a line of alarming elasticated undergarments. There was a vegetable patch with tropically lush rhubarb and neat rows of carrots, leeks and cabbages. I admired the symmetry and precision with which they had been laid out. Raymond pushed open the back door without knocking, shouting hello as he walked into the little kitchen. It smelled deliciously of soup, salty and warm, probably emanating from the large pot that sat on the hob. The floor and all the surfaces were immaculately clean and tidy, and I felt certain that were I to open a drawer or cupboard, everything inside would be pristine and neatly arranged. The decor was plain and functional, but with occasional flashes of kitsch. There was a large calendar with a lurid photograph of two kittens in a basket, and a cloth tube to store plastic bags, and designed to resemble an old-fashioned doll hung on a door handle. A single cup, glass and plate were stacked on the drainer. We walked into a tiny hall, and I followed Raymond into the living room, which again was spotless and reeked of furniture polish. A vase of chrysanthemum sat on the window ledge, and an uncurated jumble of framed photographs and ornaments were protected by the smoked glass doors of an outmoded dresser like holy relics. An old woman in an armchair reached forward for a remote to mute an enormous television. It was showing that program where people take old things to be valued, and then, if it turns out that they are worth something, pretend they like them too much to sell them. Three cats lounged on the sofa. Two glared at us, the third merely opened one eye and then went back to sleep, not deigning us worthy of a response.
"Raymond's son, come in, come in," the old woman said, pointing to the sofa and leaning forward in her chair to shoo the creatures off.
"I've brought a friend from work, Mum, hope that's okay," he said, walking forward and kissing her on the cheek.
I stepped forward and held out my hand.
"Eleanor Oliphant, pleased to meet you," I said.
She took my hand, then clasped it in both of hers, much as Sammy had done.
"Lovely to see you, hen," she said. "I'm always pleased to meet Raymond's friends. Sit down, won't you? You'll be needing a cup of tea, I'm sure. What you taking it?"
She made to stand, and I noticed the wheeled walking frame by the side of the chair.
"Stay where you are, Mum, I'll get it," Raymond said. "Shall I make us all a nice cuppa?"
"Oh, that'd be lovely, son," she said. There's some biscuits too. Wagon wheels, your favourites.
Raymond went off to the kitchen and I sat on the sofa to the right of his mother.
He's a good boy, my Raymond, she said proudly.
I was unsure how best to respond and opted for a short nod.
So you work together, she said. You fix computers too. Oh, my goodness, girls can do just about anything these days, can't they?
She was as neat and tidy as her house, a blouse fastened at the neck with a pearl brooch. She wore wine-coloured velvet slippers with a sheepskin trim which looked cosy. She was in her 70s, I'd guess, and I noticed when I shook her hand that her knuckles were swollen to the size of gooseberries. I work in accounts, Mrs. Gibbons, I said. I told her a bit about my job and she appeared to be fascinated, nodding along and occasionally saying,
Is that right? And, my, isn't that interesting?
When I ended my monologue, having exhausted the already limited conversation opportunities afforded by accounts receivable, she smiled.
Are you local, Eleanor?
She asked gently. Usually I abhor being questioned in this manner, but it was clear that her interest was genuine and without malice, so I told her where I lived, being deliberately vague as to the precise location. One should never disclose one's exact place of residence to strangers.
You don't have the accent, though?
She said, framing it as another question. I spent my early childhood down south, I said, but I moved to Scotland when I was 10.
Ah, she said, that explains it.
She seemed happy with this. I've noticed that most Scottish people don't inquire beyond down south, and I can only assume that this description encapsulates some sort of generic Englandshire for them, boat races and bowler hats, as though Liverpool and Cornwall were the same sorts of places inhabited by the same sorts of people. Conversely, they're always adamant that every part of their own country is unique and special. I'm not sure why. Raymond returned with the tea things and a packet of wagon wheels on a garish plastic tray.
Raymond, his mother said, you might have put the milk into a jug for heaven's sake. We've got a guest.
It's only Eleanor, Mum, he said, then looked at me. You don't mind, do you?
Not at all, I said. I always use the carton at home too. It's merely a vessel from which to convey the liquid into the cup. In fact, it's probably more hygienic than using an uncovered jug, I would have thought. I reached forward for a wagon wheel. Raymond was already chewing on his. The pair of them chatted about inconsequential matters and I settled into the sofa. Neither of them had particularly strident voices and I listened to the carriage clock on the mantelpiece tick loudly. It was warm, just on the right side of oppressively hot. One of the cats, lying on its side in front of the fire, stretched out to its full length with a shudder and then went back to sleep. There was a photograph next to the clock, the colours muted with age. A man, obviously Raymond's father, grinned broadly at the camera, holding up a champagne flute and a toast.
That's Raymond's dad,
his mother said, noticing. She smiled.
That was taken the day Raymond got his exam results.
She looked at him with obvious pride.
Our Raymond was the first one in the family to go to university, she said. His dad was pleased as punch. I only wish you could have been there for your graduation. What a day that was, eh, Raymond, son?
Raymond smiled, nodded.
He had a heart attack not long after I started uni, he explained to me.
Never got to enjoy his retirement, his mother said. It often happens that way.
They both sat quietly for a moment.
What did he do for a living? I asked.
I wasn't interested, but I felt it was appropriate.
Gas engineer, Raymond said.
His mother nodded.
He worked hard all his days, she said, and we never wanted for anything, did we, Raymond? We had a holiday every year in a nice wee car. At least we got to see our Denise married anyway, that's something.
I must have looked puzzled.
My sister, Raymond explained.
Oh, for goodness sake, Raymond. Too busy talking about football and computers, no doubt, and I don't suppose she wants to hear about that sort of thing anyway. Boys, hey, Eleanor?
She shook her head at me, smiling. This was puzzling. How on earth could you forget that you had a sister? He hadn't forgotten, I supposed. He'd simply taken his sibling for granted. An unchanging, unremarkable fact of life, not even worthy of mention. It was impossible for me to imagine such a scenario, alone as I was. Only Mummy and I inhabit the Oliphant world. His mother was still talking.
Denise was 11 when Raymond came along. A wee surprise and a blessing, so he was.
She looked at him with so much love that I had to turn away. At least I know what love looks like, I told myself. That's something. No one had ever looked at me like that, but I'd be able to recognise it if they ever did.
Dear son, get the album out. I'll show Eleanor those photos of that first holiday in Alicante, the summer before you started school. He got stuck in a revolving door at the airport, she said, sotto voce, leaning towards me confidentially.
I laughed out loud at the look of utter horror on Raymond's face.
Oh, Mum, Eleanor doesn't want to be bored to death looking at our old photos, he said,
blushing in a way that I suppose some people might consider charming. I thought for a moment about insisting that I'd love to see them, but he looked so miserable that I couldn't do it. Conveniently, my stomach gave a loud rumble. I'd only had the wagon wheel since my lunchtime repast of spaghetti hoops on toast. She coughed politely.
You'll stay for your tea, won't you, Eleanor? It's nothing fancy, but you're very welcome.
I looked at my watch. It was only 5:30, an odd time to eat, but I was hungry and it would still allow me time to go to Tesco on the way home. I'd be delighted, Mrs. Gibbons, I said. We sat around the small table in the kitchen. The soup was delicious. She said she'd used a pork knuckle to make stock, and then shredded the meat through the soup, which was also full of vegetables from the garden. There was bread and butter and cheese, and afterwards we had a cup of tea and a cream cake. All the while, Mrs. Gibbons regaled us with tales of her neighbours' various eccentricities and illnesses, along with updates on the activities of their extended family, which seemed to be of as little relevance to Raymond as they were to me, judging by his expression. He teased his mother frequently and affectionately, and she responded with mock annoyance, gently slapping him on the arm or chiding him for his rudeness. I was warm and full and comfortable in a way I couldn't remember feeling before. Raymond's mother heaved herself to her feet and reached for her walking frame. She had crippling arthritis in her knees and hips, Raymond told me, while she hobbled upstairs to the bathroom. The house wasn't really suitable for someone with limited mobility, but she refused to move, he said, because she'd lived all her adult life there, and it was the place where she'd brought up her family.
Now then, she said, returning from upstairs, I'll wash these few dishes, and then we can settle down and watch a bit of telly.
Raymond got straight to his feet.
Sit down, Mum, let me do it. Won't take a minute. Eleanor will help me, won't you, Eleanor?
I stood up and began gathering up the plates. Mrs. Gibbons protested vehemently, but eventually sat back down in her chair, slow and awkward, and I heard a tiny sigh of pain. Raymond washed and I dried. This was his suggestion. Somehow he'd noticed my red, sore hands, although he didn't make a hullabaloo about it. He'd merely nudged me away from the sink and thrust a tea towel, a rather jaunty one with a Scotty dog sporting a tartan bow tie, into my damaged fingers. The tea towel was soft and fibrous, as though it had been washed many times over, and had been ironed carefully into a neatly pressed square. I cast an eye over the plates before stacking them on the table for Raymond to put away. The crockery was old but good quality, painted with blousy roses and edged in faded gilt. Mrs. Gibbons saw me looking at it. There was certainly nothing wrong with her powers of observation.
That was my wedding china, Eleanor, she said. Imagine still going strong almost 50 years later.
You are the china, Raymond said, and she tutted and shook her head, smiling.
There was a comfortable silence as we worked on our respective tasks.
Tell me, are you courting at the moment, Eleanor? She asked.
How tedious.
Not presently, I said, but I have my eye on someone. It's only a matter of time.
There was a crash from the sink as Raymond dropped the ladle onto the draining board with a clatter.
Raymond, his mum said. Butterfingers.
I'd been keeping track of the musician online, of course, but he'd been rather quiet, virtually speaking. A couple of Instagram snaps of some meals he'd had, a few tweets, uninteresting Facebook updates about other people's music. I didn't mind. It was merely a matter of biding my time. If I knew one thing about romance, it was that the perfect moment for us to meet and fall in love would arrive when I least expected it, and in the most charming set of circumstances. That said, if it didn't happen soon, I'd need to take matters into my own hands.
And what about your family? She said. Do they live close by? Any brothers or sisters?
No, unfortunately, I said. I would have loved to have had siblings to grow up with. I thought about this. It's actually one of the greatest sources of sadness in my life, I heard myself say. I had never uttered such a sentence before, and indeed hadn't even fully formed the thought until this very moment. I surprised myself.
And whose fault is that, then?
A voice, whispering in my ear, cold and sharp, angry. Mummy. I closed my eyes, trying to be rid of her. Mrs. Gibbon seemed to sense my discomfort.
Oh, I'm sure that must mean you've got a lovely, close relationship with your mum and dad, then. I bet you mean the world to them, being the only one.
I looked at my shoes. Why had I selected them? I couldn't remember. They had Velcro fastenings for ease of use, and they were black, which went with everything. They were flat for comfort and built up around the ankle for support. They were, I realised, hideous.
"Don't be so nosy, Mum," Raymond said, drying his hands on the tea towel. "You're like the Gestapo."
I thought she'd be angry, but it was worse than that. She was apologetic.
"Oh, Eleanor, I'm sorry, love. I didn't mean to upset you. Please, hen, don't cry. I'm so sorry."
I was crying. Sobbing. I hadn't cried so extravagantly for years. I tried to remember the last time. It was after Deccan and I split up. Even then, those weren't emotional tears. I was crying with pain because he'd broken my arm and two ribs when I'd finally asked him to move out. This simply wasn't on. Sobbing in the kitchen of a colleague's mother. Whatever would Mummy say? I pulled myself together.
"Please don't apologise, Mrs. Gibbons," I said, my voice croaking and then splitting like a teenage boy's as I tried to calm my breath, wiping my eyes on the tea towel. She was literally wringing her hands and looked on the verge of tears herself. Raymond had his arm around her shoulder.
"Don't upset yourself, Mum. You didn't mean anything by it. She knows that, don't you, Eleanor?"
"Yes, of course," I said, and on impulse leaned across and shook her hand.
"Your question was both reasonable and appropriate. My response, however, was not. I'm at a loss to explain it. Please accept my apologies if I've made you feel uncomfortable."
She looked relieved.
"Thank God for that, hen," she said. "I wasn't expecting tears in my kitchen today."
"Aye, it's usually your cooking that makes me cry, Ma," Raymond said, and she laughed quietly. I cleared my throat.
"Your question took me unawares, Mrs. Gibbons," I said. "I never knew my father, and I know nothing about him, not even his name. Mummy is currently... let's just say she's hors de combat." I received blank looks from both of them, I was clearly not amongst francophones.
I don't ever see her. She's inaccessible, I explained. We communicate once a week, but...
Of course. Well, that would make anyone sad, love. Of course it would, she said, nodding sympathetically. Everyone needs their mum now and again, doesn't matter how old they are.
On the contrary, I said. If anything, weekly contact is too much for me. Mummy and I, we're... Well, it's complicated. Mrs. Gibbons nodded sympathetically, wanting me to continue. I, on the other hand, knew it was time to stop. An ice cream van went past in the street, the chimes playing Yankee Doodle, pitched a few painful hertz below the correct notes. I recalled the words, feathers and caps and macaroni, from some deep and completely useless vault of memories. Raymond clapped his hands together in fake bonhomie.
Right then, time's marching on. Mum, go and sit down, your programme's about to start. Eleanor, could you maybe give me a hand and bring in the washing?
I was glad to help, glad to be moving away from mummy-related conversation. There were various chores Mrs. Gibbons needed assistance with. Raymond had elected to change the cat's litter trays and empty the bins, so I'd certainly drawn the long straw with the laundry. Outside, the early evening sun was weak and pale. There was a row of gardens to the right and the left, stretching off in both directions. I placed the laundry basket on the ground and took the peg bag, on which, in looping cursive, someone had helpfully stitched pegs, and hung it on the line. The washing was dry and smelled of summer. I heard the syncopated thud of a football being kicked against a wall, and girls chanting as a skipping rope skimmed the ground. The distant chimes of the ice cream van were now almost inaudible. Someone's back door slammed, and a man's voice shouted a furious reprimand at, one hoped, a dog. There was birdsong, a descant over the sounds of a television drifting through an open window. Everything felt safe. Everything felt normal. How different Raymond's life had been from mine. A proper family. A mother and a father and a sister nestled amongst other proper families. How different it was still. Every Sunday. Here. This. Back indoors, I helped Raymond swap the sheets on his mother's bed for the clean ones I'd brought in from the line. Her bedroom was very pink and smelled of talcum powder. It was clean and nondescript. Not like a hotel room, more like a bed and breakfast, I imagined. Save for a fat paperback and a packet of extra strong mints on the bedside table, there was nothing personal in the room, no clue to the owner's personality. It struck me that, in the nicest possible way, she didn't really have a personality. She was a mother. A kind, loving woman about whom no one would ever say, "She was crazy, that Betty," or "You'll never guess what Betty's done now," or "After reviewing psychiatric reports, Betty was refused bail on grounds that she posed an extreme risk to the general public." She was, quite simply, a nice lady who'd raised a family and now lived quietly with her cats and grew vegetables. This was both nothing and everything. "Did your sister help out with your mother, Raymond?" I asked. He was grappling with a duvet, and I took it from him. There is a knack to such things. Raymond is a man without the knack. He put on the pillowcases, flowers, ruffles, instead. "Nah," he said, concentrating. "She's got two kids, and they're about a handful. Mark works offshore, so she's a single parent for weeks at a time, really. It's not easy. It'll be better when the kids are at school," she says.
"Ah," I said. Do you enjoy being an uncle, then?"
Uncle Raymond, a somewhat unlikely role model, I felt. He shrugged.
"Yeah, they're good fun. There's not much to it, to be honest. I just bung them some cash at Christmas and birthdays, take them to the park a couple of times a month. Job done."
I would never be an aunt, of course. Probably just as well.
You had a lucky escape with Mum and the photo albums this time, Eleanor, Raymond said. She'll bore the pants off you next time about the grandkids, just you wait and see.
He was making a lot of assumptions there, I thought, but I let it pass. I looked at my watch, surprised to see it was after 8.
I must be off, Raymond, I said.
If you want to hang on for another hour or so, I'll be done here and we can get the bus together, he said.
I declined, naturally. I went downstairs and thanked Mrs. Gibbons for tea. She, in turn, thanked me profusely for coming and for helping with the chores.
Eleanor, it's been lovely, so it has, she said. I haven't been beyond the garden for months now, these knees of mine, so it's a pleasure to see a new face, and such a friendly one at that. You've been a great help around the house, too. Thanks, Hen, thanks very much.
I smiled at her, twice in one day to be the recipient of thanks and warm regard. I would never have suspected that small deeds could elicit such genuine, generous responses. I felt a little glow inside, not a blaze, more like a small, steady candle.
"Come back any time, Eleanor. I'm always in. You don't have to come, we," she jabbed a finger Raymondwards. "Him? Just come yourself if you like. You know where I am now. Don't be a stranger."
On impulse, I leaned forward and brushed my cheek, not the scarred one, the normal one, close to hers. It wasn't a kiss or an embrace, but it was as close as I was able to come.
"Cheerio," she said. "Safe home now."
Raymond walked me to the end of the road to show me where the bus stop was located. "I'd probably have a bit of a wait, it being Sunday," he said. I shrugged. I was used to waiting, and life has taught me to be a very patient person.
"See you tomorrow then, Eleanor," he said.
I took up my travel pass and showed it to him. "Unlimited travel," I said. He nodded, gave a small smile. Miraculously, the bus arrived. I raised my hand and climbed on board. I stared straight ahead as the bus pulled away to avoid any awkwardness with waving. It had been quite a day. I felt drained, but something had crystallized in my mind. These new people, new adventures, this contact. I found it overwhelming, but to my surprise, not at all unpleasant. I'd coped surprisingly well, I thought. I'd met new people, introduced myself to them, and we'd spent problem-free social time together. If there was one thing I could take from today's experiences, it was this. I was nearly ready to declare my intentions to the musician. The time for our momentous first encounter was drawing ever closer. Chapter 11. I didn't see Raymond on Monday or on Tuesday. I didn't think about him, although my mind did return to Sammy and to Mrs. Gibbons on occasion. I could, of course, visit either or both of them without Raymond being there. Indeed, both had stressed that to me on Sunday. But would it be better if he were by my side? I suspected that it would, not least because he could always fill a silence with banal, inane comments and questions should the need arise. In the meantime, I'd gone to the mobile telephone emporium with the least garish fascia in the closest location to the office, and on the highly suspect advice of a bored salesperson, had eventually purchased a reasonably priced handset and package, which allowed me to make calls, access the internet, and also do various other things, most of which were of no interest to me. He'd mentioned apps and games. I asked about crosswords, but was very disappointed with his response. I was familiarising myself with the manual for the new device, rather than completing the VAT details on Mr. Leonard's invoice, when, very much against my will, I became aware of the conversation going on around me, due to its excessive volume. It was, of all things, on the topic of our annual Christmas lunch.
"Yeah, but they have entertainment laid on there, and lots of other big groups go so we can meet new people. Have a laugh," Bernadette was saying. "Entertainment?
I wondered if that would involve a band, and if so, might it be his band? A very early Christmas miracle? Was this fate interceding once again? Before I could ask for details, Billy jumped in.
You just want to cop off with some drunk guy from Allied Carpets under the mistletoe, Billy said. There's no way I'm paying 60 quid a head for a dry roast turkey dinner and a cheesy afternoon disco, not just so as you can scout for talent.
Bernadette cackled and slapped him on the arm.
No, she said, it's not that. I just think it might be more fun if there's a bigger crowd there, that's all.
Janie looked slyly at the others, thinking that I hadn't seen her. I saw her eyes flick up to my scars, as they often did.
Let's ask Harry Potter over there, she said,
not quite sotto voce, and then turned to address me.
Eleanor? Hey, Eleanor, you're a bit of a girl about town, aren't you? What do you reckon? Where should we go for the office Christmas lunch this year?
I looked pointedly at the office wall calendar, which this month displayed a photograph of a green articulated lorry. It's the middle of summer, I said. I can't say I've really given it any thought.
Yeah, she said. But we've got to get something booked up now, otherwise all the good places get taken and you get left with, like, Wetherspoons or a rubbish Italian.
It's a matter of supreme indifference to me, I said. I shan't be going anyway. I rubbed at the cracked skin between my fingers. It was healing, but the process was painfully slow.
Oh, that's right, she said. You never go, do you? I'd forgotten about that. You don't do the Secret Santa either. Eleanor the Grinch, that's what we ought to call you.
They all laughed. I don't understand that cultural reference, I said. However, to clarify, I'm an atheist and I'm not consumer-oriented, so the midwinter shopping festival, otherwise known as Christmas, is of little interest to me. I went back to my work, hoping it would inspire them to do the same. They are like small children, easily distracted, and content to spend what feels like hours discussing trivialities and gossiping about people they don't know.
Sounds like somebody had a bad experience in Santa's grotto back in the day, said Billy.
And then, thankfully, the phone rang. I smiled sadly. He couldn't even begin to imagine the sort of bad experiences I'd had back in the day. It was an internal call. Raymond, asking if I wanted to go and visit Sammy again with him tonight. A Wednesday. I'd miss my weekly chat with Mummy. I'd never missed one, not in all these years. But then what could she actually do about it, after all? There couldn't be much harm in skipping it just this once, and Sammy was in need of nutritious food. I said yes. Our rendezvous was scheduled for 5:30. I'd insisted that we meet outside the post office, fearing the reaction of my co-workers were we to be observed leaving work together. It was a mild, pleasant evening, so we decided to walk to the hospital, which would take only 20 minutes. Raymond was certainly in need of the exercise.
How was your day, Eleanor?
He said, smoking as we walked. I changed sides, trying to position myself downwind of the noxious toxins. Fine, thank you. I had a cheese and pickle sandwich for lunch with ready salted crisps and a mango smoothie. He blew smoke out of the side of his mouth and laughed.
Anything else happen? Or just the sandwich?
I thought about this. There was a protracted discussion about Christmas lunch venues, I said. Apparently it's been narrowed down to TGI Fridays because it's a laugh. Here I tried out a little finger-waggling gesture indicating quotation marks, which I'd seen Janie doing once and had stored away for future reference. I think I carried it off with aplomb, or else the Bombay Bistro Christmas Buffet.
Nothing says Christmas like a lamb biryani, eh?
Raymond said. He stubbed out his cigarette, discarding it on the pavement. We arrived at the hospital and I waited while Raymond, typically disorganized, went into the shop on the ground floor. There really is no excuse for being unprepared. I had already gone to Marks and Spencer before meeting him and had purchased some choice items there, including a tub of pumpkin seeds. I suspected Sammy was in dire need of zinc. Raymond came out swinging a carrier bag. In the lift, he opened it and showed me what he'd bought.
Haribo, the Evening Times, big tub of sour cream and chive Pringles. What more could a man ask for, eh?
He said, looking quite proud of himself. I did not dignify this with a response. We paused at the ward entrance. Sammy's bed was surrounded by visitors. He saw us and beckoned us over. I looked around, but the stern nurse with the stripy socks was nowhere to be seen. Sammy was reclining regally on a mound of pillows, addressing the assembled throng.
"Eleanor! Raymond! Great to see ye! Come and meet the family. Well, this is Keith. The kiddies are at home with their mum. And this is Gary and Michelle. And this..."
He indicated a blonde woman who was texting with impressive focus on her mobile telephone.
"Is my daughter Laura."
I was aware of everyone smiling and nodding, and then they were shaking our hands, slapping Raymond's back. It was quite overwhelming. I'd put on my white cotton gloves rather than use the hand gel. I reasoned that I could run through a boil wash as soon as I got home. This occasioned a certain hesitancy in the handshakes, which was strange. Surely a cotton barrier between our respective skin surfaces could only be a good thing.
"Thanks so much for taking care of my dad, guys," the older brother, Keith, said, wiping his hands on the front of his trousers. "It means a lot to know he wasn't on his own when it happened, that he had people looking out for him."
"Hey now," said Sammy, nudging him with his elbow. "I'm not some doddery old invalid, you know. I can look after myself."
They smiled at one another.
"Course you can, Dad. I'm just saying, it's nice to have a friendly face around sometimes, eh?"
Sammy shrugged, not conceding the point, but graciously allowing it to pass.
"I've got some good news for you two," Sammy said to us, leaning back contentedly into his pillows while Raymond and I deposited our carrier bags like myrrh and frankincense at the foot of his bed. "I'm getting out on Saturday."
Raymond high-fived him, after some initial awkwardness whereby Sammy had no idea why a podgy hand had been thrust in his face. "He's coming to stay at mine for a couple of weeks, just till he gets confident with the walking frame," his daughter Laura said, finally looking up from her phone. "We're having a wee party to celebrate. You're both invited, of course," she added, somewhat less than enthusiastically. She was staring at me. I didn't mind. In fact, I actually prefer that to surreptitious, sneaky glances. From her, I got a full and frank appraisal, filled with fascination, but with no trace of fear or disgust. I brushed my hair off my face so that she could get a better view. "This Saturday," I said.
"Now, Eleanor, don't you dare say you're busy," Sammy said. "No excuses. I want you both there. End of."
"Who are we to argue?" Raymond said, smiling.
I thought about it. A party. The last party I'd been to, apart from that appalling wedding reception, was on Judy Jackson's 13th birthday. It had involved ice skating and milkshakes and hadn't ended well. Surely no one was likely to vomit or lose a finger at an elderly invalid's welcome home celebration. "I shall attend," I said, inclining my head.
"Here's my card," Laura said, passing one each to Raymond and to me.
It was black and glossy, embossed with gold leaf, and said, "Laura Marston Smith, Aesthetic Technician, Hairstylist, Image Consultant," with her contact details set out below.
7 o'clock on Saturday, yeah? Don't bring anything, just yourselves."
I tucked the card carefully into my purse. Raymond had thrust his into his back pocket. He couldn't take his eyes off Laura, I noticed, apparently hypnotized rather in the manner of a mongoose before a snake. She was clearly aware of this. I suspected she was used to it, looking the way she did. Blonde hair and large breasts are so clichéd, so obvious. Men like Raymond, pedestrian dullards, would always be distracted by women who looked like her, having neither the wit nor the sophistication to see beyond mammaries and peroxide. Raymond tore his eyes away from Laura's decolletage and looked at the wall clock, then, pointedly, at me.
"We shall depart," I said, "and meet again on Saturday."
Once again there was an overwhelming onslaught of salutations and handshakes. Sammy, meanwhile, was rummaging in the bags we'd brought. He held up a packet of organic curly kale.
"What the hell is this?"
he said, incredulous.
"Zinc,"
I whispered to myself. Raymond hustled me out of the ward rather brusquely, I felt, and before I'd even had a chance to mention that the squid salad would need to be eaten promptly, the ambient temperature in the hospital ward was very warm.
Chapter 12.
The next day, whilst waiting for the kettle to boil, my eye was drawn to a leaflet which had been discarded on top of the office recycling bag, alongside a pile of holiday brochures and well-thumbed gossip magazines. It was for a department store in town, not one I ever had frequented, and set out an introductory offer featuring a frankly spectacular one-third reduction in the price of a deluxe pamper manicure. I tried and failed to imagine what a deluxe pamper manicure might involve. How might one introduce luxury and pampering into the process of shaping and painting a nail? It was, literally, beyond my imagining. I felt a thrill of excitement. There was only one way to find out. With my animal grooming regime in mind, I would turn my attention to my talons. I had somewhat neglected my self-improvement plans of late, distracted by Sammy's unfortunate accident and the events which had resulted from it. But it was time to refocus on my goal, the musician. I indulged in the sin of pride for a moment. My nails grow exceedingly fast, and they are strong and shiny. I attribute this to a diet high in the requisite vitamins, minerals, and fatty acids, which are obtained from my well-planned luncheon regime. My nails are a tribute to the culinary excellence of the British High Street. Not being a vain person, I merely cut them with clippers when they grow too long to allow for comfortable data input, and file down the resulting sharp corners so that they do not snag on fabric or scrape my skin unpleasantly when I am bathing. So far, so perfectly adequate. My nails are always clean. Clean nails, like clean shoes, are fundamental to self-respect. Whilst I am neither stylish nor fashionable, I am always clean. That way, at least, I can hold my head up when I take my place, however unexalted, in the world. I headed into town during my lunch break, eating my sandwich on the way in order to save time. On reflection, I wished that I had selected a less obtrusive filling. Egg and cress was perhaps not the most judicious choice for a busy, warm train carriage, and both the sandwich and I were attracting disapproving looks from our fellow travellers. I abhor eating in public at the best of times, so the 8-minute journey was not a pleasant experience for anyone concerned. I found the nail concession at the rear of the beauty hall, a vast chandelier-lit barn of mirrors, scents and noise. I felt like a trapped animal, a steer or a rabid dog, and imagined the chaos I'd cause if, careering wildly, I was corralled in there against my will. I clutched the leaflet tight in my fist, balled up inside my jerkin pocket. Nails etc., what extras did the Latin term refer, I wondered, appeared to consist of 2 bored children in white tunics, a breakfast bar with 4 stools and a rack of polishes in every hue from clear to tar. I approached with caution.
"Welcome to Nails etc., how can I help you today?"
said the smaller girl child. It took me a moment to translate.
"Good afternoon," I said slowly, and in an exaggeratedly modulated voice, to give her a clue as to how one ought to speak in order to communicate effectively. She and her companion were both staring, their expressions a combination of alarm and, well, alarm mainly. I smiled in what I hoped was a reassuring manner. They were so young, after all. Perhaps this was some sort of work experience, and they were awaiting the return of their teacher.
"I'd like a deluxe pamper manicure, please," I said, as clearly as I could.
There was a long, still pause where nothing happened. The shorter one was first awake from her trance.
"Take a seat," she said, indicating the nearest stool.
Her companion remained transfixed. The shorter one, Casey, according to her name badge, bustled about distractedly and then perched opposite, having first set down a kidney bowl slopping with hot soapy water. She swiveled the rack of polishes towards me.
"What colour would you like?" she said.
My eye was drawn to a bright green hue, the same shade as a poisonous Amazonian frog, the tiny, delightfully deadly ones. I handed it to her. She nodded. She wasn't actually chewing gum, but her demeanour was very much that of a gum chewer. She took my hands and placed the tips of all 10 fingers into the warm water. I kept a watchful eye to ensure that no other flesh made contact with the unknown detergent substances for fear of inflaming my eczema. I sat there for several minutes, feeling rather foolish, while she rummaged in a nearby drawer and returned with a variety of stainless steel tools carefully laid out on a tray. Her catatonic companion had finally sprung to life and was chatting enthusiastically to a co-worker at a different concession. I couldn't discern the topic, but it seemed to prompt some eye-rolling and shrugging. Casey deemed the moment apposite to remove my hands from the water, and she then laid them on a folded flannel. She carefully patted each fingertip dry. I wondered why she hadn't simply asked me to remove my hands, using her voice, and passed me the towel, so I could dry them using my hands, since I was enjoying, at current point of reporting, full use and motor function in all limbs and extremities. Perhaps that was what pampering meant, though, literally not having to lift a finger. Casey set to work with the tools, pushing back my cuticles and trimming them when required. I essayed some chit-chat, aware that this was the done thing in the circumstances.
"Have you worked here long?" I asked. 2 years, she said.
To my astonishment, she appeared to be around 14 years of age, and to the best of my knowledge, child labour was still outlawed in this country.
"And did you always want to be a..."
I grappled for the word. "Manicurist?"
"Nail technician,"
she corrected me. She was intent on her task and did not look at me while she talked, which I approved of enormously. There is categorically no need for eye contact when the person concerned is wielding sharp implements.
"I wanted either to work with animals or to be a nail technician," she continued.
She had moved on to a hand massage now. More deluxe pampering, presumably, although I found it rather pointless and ineffectual and was concerned for potential allergic reactions. Her hands were tiny, almost as small as mine, which are, unfortunately, abnormally small, like a dinosaur's. I would have preferred a man's hands to massage mine. Larger, stronger, firmer, hairier.
"So, yeah," she said. "I couldn't decide between animals or nails, so I asked my mum, and she said I should go for nail technician."
She picked up an emery board and began to shape my nails. It was an awkward process, one that would definitely have been easier to do oneself.
"Is your mother an economist or a qualified careers advisor?" I said.
Casey stared at me. Because if not, then I'm not sure that her advice was necessarily informed by the latest data on earnings projections and labour market demand, I said, quite concerned for her future prospects.
"She's a travel agent," Casey said firmly, as if that settled the matter.
I let it drop. It was no concern of mine after all, and she seemed happy enough at her work.
The thought did strike me as she painted on various coats of various varnishes, that she could have perhaps combined the two professions by becoming a dog groomer. However, I elected to keep my counsel on the matter. Sometimes when you tried to help with suggestions, it could lead to misunderstandings, not all of them entirely pleasant.
She placed my hands into a small machine which was, I assumed, a hairdryer for nails, and a few minutes later the deluxe pampering was done. All in all, the experience had been rather underwhelming. She advised me of the price. It was, frankly, extortionate. "I have a leaflet," I said. She nodded, not even asking to check it,
and deducted the requisite one-third, stating the revised amount, which still left me reeling. I reached for my shopper. She said, "Stop!" in a very alarming fashion. I did.
"You smudged them," she said.
She leaned forward.
"I'll get your purse out for you if you like."
I was concerned that this might be some elaborate ruse to part me from even more of my hard-earned cash, so I watched her like the proverbial hawk as she reached inside my bag. Too late, I remembered the unfinished remains of the egg sandwich which lay within. She gagged ostentatiously as she removed my purse. A slight overreaction, I felt. Yes, the odour which escaped was somewhat sulphurous, but still no need for pantomime. I kept my eyes fixed on her fingers, unpainted, I noticed, as she extracted the required notes and replaced the purse in the shopper very carefully. I stood up, ready to take my leave. Her erstwhile companion had returned and cast a glance at my hands, their tips gleaming green.
"Nice," she said,
her tone and body language implying strongly that she had little interest in the topic. Casey became slightly more animated.
"Would you like a loyalty card?" she said. "Have 5 manicures and the 6 ones free?"
"No, thank you," I said. "I shan't be having a manicure again. I can do the same thing myself at home, better for nothing." Their mouths fell open slightly, but with that I was off, making my way back out into the world, dodging the squirters and the sample pushers on my way past the perfume counters. I longed to be outside in natural light and fresh air again. The gilded confines of the beauty hall were not my preferred habitat. Like the chicken that had laid the eggs for my sandwich, I was more of a free-range creature. I got home after work and opened my wardrobe. What to wear to a party? I had 2 pairs of black trousers and 5 white blouses, well, they were white originally, which I wore to work. I had a comfortable pair of slacks, 2 T-shirts and 2 jumpers, which I wore at weekends. That left my special occasion outfit. I'd bought it for Loretta's wedding reception years ago, and I'd worn it on a handful of occasions since, including a special visit to the National Museum of Scotland. The exhibition of newly discovered Roman Trove had been tremendous, the journey to Edinburgh far less so. The train interior had been more like a bus than the Orient Express, replete with hard-wearing fabrics and stain-concealing colours and grey plastic fittings. The worst thing, apart from the other travellers, my goodness, the hoi polloi do get about these days, and they eat and drink in public with very few inhibitions, was the incessant noise from the loudspeakers. It seemed there was an announcement every 5 minutes from the mythical conductor, imparting sagacious gems such as large items should be placed in the overhead luggage racks, or that passengers should report any unattended items to the train crew as soon as possible. I wondered at whom these pearls of wisdom were aimed. Some passing extraterrestrial, perhaps? Or a yak herder from Ulaanbaatar who had trekked across the steppes, sailed the North Sea, and found himself on the Glasgow to Edinburgh service with literally no prior experience of mechanised transport to call upon? The special occasion outfit was, I realised, somewhat outmoded now. Lemon was not a colour that suited me particularly well, fine for nightgowns worn in the privacy of my bedroom, but hardly suitable for a sophisticated gathering. I'd go to the shops tomorrow and purchase something new. I'd be able to wear it again when I was out at a restaurant or at the theatre with my true love, so the money would not be wasted. Feeling happy with this decision, I made my usual pasta con pesto and listened to the Archers. There was a convoluted storyline involving a very unconvincing Glaswegian milkman, and I did not particularly enjoy the episode. I'd washed up and settled down with a book about pineapples. It was surprisingly interesting. I like to read as widely as possible for many reasons, not least in order to broaden my vocabulary to assist with crossword solving. Then the silence was very rudely interrupted. "Hello," I said, somewhat tentatively.
"Oh, so it's hello, is it? Hello? That's all you've got to say to me? And where the hell were you last night, lady, hmm?"
She was playing to the gallery again.
"Mummy," I said, "how are you?"
I tried my best to steady myself.
"Never mind how I am. Where were you?"
"I'm sorry, Mummy," I said, trying to keep my voice even. I was with a friend, visiting another friend in hospital, actually."
"Oh, Eleanor," she said, her voice oozingly oleaginous. "You don't have friends, darling. Now come on, tell me where you really were, and I want the truth this time. Were you doing something naughty? Tell Mummy, there's a good girl."
"Honestly, Mummy, I was out with Raymond." There was a snort.
"Visiting this nice old man in hospital. He fell in the street and we helped him and..." "Shut your lying little cakehole!"
I flinched, dropped the book, picked it up again.
"You know what happens to liars, don't you, Eleanor? You remember?"
Her voice was back to sickly sweet.
"I don't mind how bad the truth is, but I won't tolerate lies, Eleanor. You of all people should know that, even after all this time."
"Mummy, I'm sorry if you don't believe me, but it's true. Raymond and I went to hospital to visit a man we'd helped when he had an accident. It's true, I swear it."
"Really?" she drawled. "Well, that's just delightful, isn't it? You can't be bothered to talk to your own mother, and yet you spend your Wednesday evenings visiting some geriatric, accident-prone stranger. Charming."
"Please, Mummy, let's not fight. How are you? Have you had a good day?"
"I don't want to talk about me, Eleanor. I already know all about me. I want to talk about you. How is your project coming along? Any news for Mummy?"
I might have known she'd remember. How much should I tell her? Everything, I supposed.
"I went to his house, Mummy," I said.
I heard the click of a lighter and then a long exhaled breath. I could almost smell the smoke from her sobriety.
"Ooh," she said, "interesting."
She took in another lungful and expelled it with a sigh.
"Who's this he?"
"He's a musician, Mummy." I didn't want to tell her his name quite yet. There is a power in naming things, and I wasn't quite ready to cede it to her yet, to hear those precious syllables rolled in her mouth for her to spit them out again.
"And he's handsome and clever and... well, I think he's the perfect man for me, really. I knew it as soon as I saw him."
"That all sounds rather marvellous, darling. And you went to his house, did you? Tell me, what did you find there?"
I sniffed.
"The thing is, Mummy, I didn't actually go inside."
This wasn't going to be easy. She liked doing bad things, and I didn't. It was as simple as that. I spoke quickly, hoping to head off the inevitable criticism.
"I just wanted to have a quick look, make sure he lived somewhere appropriate," I said,
stumbling over the words in my haste to get them out. She sighed.
"And how are you supposed to know whether it's nice if you didn't go inside? You always were overcautious and lily-livered, darling," she said, sounding bored.
I looked at my hands. The chipped green nails looked so garish in this light.
"What you have to do, Eleanor," she said, "is grasp the nettle. Do you know what I mean by that?"
"I think so," I whispered.
"I'm simply telling you that you mustn't keep pussyfooting around, Eleanor," she sighed. "Life is all about taking decisive action, darling. Whatever you want to do, do it. Whatever you want to take, grab it. Whatever you want to bring to an end, end it. And live with the consequences."
She started to talk quietly, speaking so softly that I could hardly hear her. This, I knew from experience, did not bode well.
"This man," she murmured. "This man sounds as if he has some potential, but like most people, he'll be weak.
That means that you have to be strong, Eleanor. Strength conquers weakness. That's a simple fact of life, isn't it?
I suppose so.